Hi, I'm Addie Robertson with The Verge, and I'm here with Katie Drummond, and we're talking about December's book club pick, which is Raymond Chandler's The Big Sleep.
Hello.
So we were sort of split on this.
Yeah.
So which is a nice way to start this.
I will sort of start by saying, just for background, that I knew nothing about this book, nothing about Raymond Chandler. When I found out what we were reading for December, I think I just downloaded it on my Kindle and started reading. I didn't look into it at all. And I think given what we had read in the last couple of months, sort of The Circle, Eggers, and Stephen King, I thought I was getting myself into some other sci-fi or horror adventure, which is great for me usually. And started reading this and was like, what the hell is this? And I kept feeling that way right through to the end of the book. I did not enjoy this at all.
And so I've read some Raymond Chandler. I've read some other stuff, a little bit of Dashiell Hammett, some basically things from the authors of all the books that we were going to pick from this year's or last year's noir edition. And I've even seen the first movie of The Big Sleep. And yet I was totally blindsided by this book. But I still find it super fascinating.
What in particular was it that you found sort of fascinating about this? Because maybe I'll appreciate it more if I can glean some insight.
So basically, it's like reading something. It's basically like reading science fiction, because it is like reading a book from someone who does not operate from any of the premises that modern normal human beings operate from. It is set in this insane alternate continuity that was, I guess, 70 years ago.
Yeah.
Where, like, women are all not even really human, and nobody, like, everyone is trying to double-cross everyone else, and there are pornography lending libraries.
Yeah.
Which was honestly the weirdest part of the book for me.
That was very strange. And I was doing a bit of background after I finished the book, just to sort of think about what I wanted to talk about. And there was some essay I read, and I have this written, that for Raymond Chandler, the plot was secondary in importance to, and I quote, interesting characters who behave in believable ways. And I saw that and just thought, like, no, they don't. I did not find that there was sort of a believable character, or sort of I found motivations very difficult to sort of pick up and follow. I don't know if you agree with that.
See, that's weird, because that's not ever actually anything I've thought was good about Chandler. It's atmosphere.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing that he contributed, is that he's really good.
Yeah.
Like, that his descriptions and everything in the world hangs together really well, because his weird double-crossing aesthetic is its own aesthetic.
Right. Yeah, the atmosphere was sort of what I took away from this, in just that when he was going on these long tangents about the weather or a certain room, it was really beautiful and really well written and executed. It was more the characters and the actual plot itself that I didn't care for. So should we like briefly sum up what this book was about from what we can tell?
Okay, I will take a stab at summarizing what this was about. Philip Marlowe is a private eye who is Humphrey Bogart to most people. And he is called in on a blackmailing case, which appears to be straightforward, but then quickly spirals out of control with a bunch of murders and some double-crossing and a bunch of rackets, vice rackets, gambling, murder rackets, all centered around the two wild daughters of the man who is being blackmailed, one of whom is this blonde, this sort of impetuous, ditzy blonde who is constantly getting herself blackmailed because she appears in, like, nude photo shoots, and the other one, of whom is more of a femme fatale, Vivian, who is married to a man who has mysteriously disappeared and is believed he's run off with the wife of a mobster.
Oh, so confusing already.
Then pretty much all of them die.
Right, they pretty much all do die. And the blonde sister, her name was Carmen, right?
Yes.
What is wrong with Carmen?
She has epilepsy.
Is that okay? That's what it is?
It's discovered in the last five pages of the book.
So throughout the book, I was like, there's something wrong with this woman. Like, at first I was like, oh, she's just being portrayed as sort of this hysterical bimbo, which
oh,
is...
Oh, she's also hysterical, but she has epilepsy.
And then sort of the last few pages, you get this, like, back and forth between Marlowe and Vivian talking about Carmen's health problems. And from what I can remember, just finishing it yesterday, they never come right out and say she has epilepsy, but she has fits or seizures, I think is what they...
She has seizures. She seems to just have some kind of weird, like, mental retardation, strange thing that makes her... Like, they describe her constantly as sucking her thumb, mm-hmm. And that she just even in the world of Raymond Chandler, behaves really weirdly.
Right.
Like that the plot hinges on her killing someone because he wouldn't sleep with her.
Right.
Because she believes herself to be totally irresistible, which is granted just a theme in every every Philip Marlowe novel I've ever read.
Well, and that was one challenge I had in sort of figuring that character out, is that he portrays women as just, you know, by and large, just sort of like objects, like pieces of furniture in how he describes them. And so I had a really hard time telling if he was just portraying Carmen as I said, this hysterical bimbo who just like thinks about sex and nudie photos and sucking her thumb. And if that was just an extension of the way he describes other women, or if he was portraying a woman with sort of mental health problems or physical health problems that were impacting her behavior. Like, I couldn't tell if there was more nuance there or if it was just his furniture portrayal of women taken to the next level.
See, I actually think furniture is not the right word. I think – so there's a part at the end where he's talking to – I don't think she ever actually even gets a name. He calls her Silverwig. It's the mobster's wife who's – part of some kind of convoluted plot and is being kept somewhere. And he talks about her having this weird sort of animal gleam in her eyes and that she's like the clever sort of fox, like all of these terms, like basically they are animals,
right?
Like not in the way that they're like that they are, you know, must be treated badly, although they must, but in the way that they just, their behaviors are sort of alien and simplistic and they're unable to understand logic and they behave in ways that, you know, like a rabid dog, except one that's totally harmless and can't actually do anything.
Right. Right.
They're house cats. Also, Carmen hisses.
She hisses
constantly. Yeah.
As sort of her, that's when she's in threatening mode.
Yes.
Yeah. That was really strange. And what about Marlowe? I mean, what did you think of him as sort of a character? I have to say that it's funny. I have not seen the movies, so Humphrey Bogart is not what came to mind for me. What I kept thinking of was Jason Schwartzman's PI character in his short-lived, I believe it was an HBO comedy caper series, co-starring Zach Galifianakis and Ted Danson.
I've never seen this. I don't know what.
I need to look this up. I think it might be even inspired by it's certainly inspired by sort of noir crime solving shows, but it's obviously a comedy. I mean, it's ridiculous, but it's very good.
See, I imagine him looking kind of like a Frank Miller character. He seems like he would have that kind of squat, tons of lines on his face thing, because he's a really, like, he's the least charming man on earth.
Right.
Which is his whole shtick, that he's this war-hardened cynic.
Right.
Who is impervious to women.
And also to sort of, I sort of felt like he was portrayed as, you know, this shining knight living in this very corrupt, seedy underworld where even the police were corrupt. You know, he was dealing with mobsters and hitmen and pornography fiends, and he was just sort of above that fray. The show is bored to death. Inspired by detective stories, a well-meaning but struggling writer decides to lead a double life by pretending to be a private detective. So I guess it's not quite the same, but that's what I thought of.
But that's the thing, is that everything is pretty much based on, like, Raymond Chandler has influenced every single piece of detective fiction, with the exception of the stuff that's based on Sherlock Holmes.
Right.
Forever. Which I feel like is actually – so I didn't really end up having a problem with the misogyny or the racism or the homophobia because it just all seemed ridiculous.
Right.
Like that he just seemed laughable for like looking at somebody and being like, oh, you're gay. You can't throw a punch.
Right. And I mean, I guess also sort of reflecting on the era in which this was written. This is what, 1936 or something?
39.
So, you know.
Yeah. It's weird because I get upset by that in almost everything else. But for some reason, this is the thing that seems so over the top.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that I do actually get angry at everything that is based on this because this is something that they have done very little to update.
How so? I haven't read much sort of in this genre.
Oh, I mean, I don't even mean in this genre. I mean sort of the pastiches of him directly. Like the thing I'm thinking about right now is Looper, which is very sort of loosely noir, but that it is still a thing that even, it's not terrible, but that largely places women, they are mothers, they are prostitutes, right, they are girlfriends. Right. And that's something that I feel like is very common, that we never really get past that because we see it as just part and parcel of this. Or the Yiddish Policeman's Union, which we also read, is getting beyond that, but is still like clearly kind of dealing with it.
And this is 70 years ago.
Yeah.
So,
like, that it's weird that we can't seem to shake that off because it's so much a part of the aesthetic.
Hmm.
or Max Payne, in which is very explicitly, it's this ridiculous Chandler-esque prose where everything is, you know, the pitchforks of angels raining down on the city like hard rain. But that is, you know, Max Payne avenging his wife with a femme fatale.
I have not seen that either. I guess I'm not very...
Oh, no, that's a game, but it was a movie, which I never saw, that had Mark Wahlberg in it.
And so you noted here that Chandler has been endlessly parodied and given homages. So how did that affect the way that you read this book, and what are some of these parodies that you are referencing?
So I'm thinking of that. I'm thinking of, A, sort of Max Payne, B, just anything that uses his, like, private detective, hard-boiled style, which is pretty much, which is just a ton of things. Like any joke episode of something where somebody tries to solve a crime or becomes a private detective and they make some kind of gritty monologue.
Yeah.
It's that. But the weird thing is that his actual action scenes kind of read like farce to me. So there's a scene where where Philip Marlowe is talking to someone, and then Carmen bursts in with a gun, and then I think someone else bursts in with a gun, and then Marlowe proceeds to take the guns away from all of them, and then, like, it's just this weird kind of moment of, it's like an action scene, but it comes across as just physical comedy.
Just sort of slapstick, like, I feel like it would make, in some cases, very good theater.
Yeah. Which I don't feel like I've actually seen a lot of stuff with, granted, I really, noir is, and hardboiled is an area that I am fairly weak in, but I feel like I've seen much more attention paid to the language than I have to the sort of physicality of it.
Right.
I'm trying to find this moment because I think I bookmarked it. Oh, yes, and it also ties in with his other favorite thing, which is slapping women or hitting them in some way. Okay, I stepped past the crawling girl and I picked the gun up. She looked at me and began to giggle. I put her gun in my pocket and patted her on the back. Get up, Angel. You look like a Pekingese. I went over to Brody and put the automatic against his midriff and reached his Colt out of his side pocket. I had all the guns that had been exposed to view. I stuffed them into my pockets. And then he gets an envelope from Brody, and then he nods again, and then Agnes gets back, and then she gets back up her feet and is giggling and hissing, and there's froth at the corners of her mouth, and then she asks for the gun, and then she sucks her thumb again, and then I think there's another gun that goes off, and he hits her, and she runs out.
I don't even remember that scene, but it sounds ridiculous.
I really liked it, but in a way where I kind of feel like I'm mocking the book, mm-hmm. which is funny because I always remember myself loving, like, the little bits of this that I had read. And then I go back to it, and it just feels like it hasn't, that parts of it have held up so poorly that they impugn the better parts of it.
Do you feel like the parts that have held up poorly are the sort of un-PC portrayals, or is it more than that to you?
I'm not sure. A part of it is that the portrayals collar it because there are a fair number of women in the book.
Yeah.
And that it just sort of makes like half the characters these weird cardboard cutouts.
Yeah, definitely. Women are sort of, that's interesting. I mean, they are sort of a dominant force in the book in the sense that essentially the plot revolves around Philip Marlowe and then these two sisters. And yet they have very little sort of depth as characters.
Yeah, which just, like, that's sort of the problem, is that it's not, like, when we talk about sort of un-PC, the implication is just, oh, these women are worried about this. But it actually makes the book really weird.
Yeah.
In a way that is not at all good. Wait, you had mentioned If Hollywood Goes for a Third Round, which I think really interesting.
Yeah, I was thinking about this. I mean, as I said, I haven't seen either of the film adaptations. I don't know if they're any good. Are they the one that you've seen?
I mean, the first one is a fairly well-acknowledged classic, and it is pretty great, in part because he can't do all of the sort of internal exposition about how horrible everything is.
Does he speak to the camera?
I do not recall. I do not think so. But
just wondering.
I'm not sure.
Yeah. I feel like that would be, that's in sort of detective type movies and TV shows I've seen. There's a lot of that usually, but maybe not. So what do you think the third version would look like?
I'm not sure because, A, I'm not sure exactly how it could be set because there are just so many things that would not work now. Well, I mean, a lot of it would transition over fairly well, but it seems like so much of it is based on these ideas of women in which they are these weird malign forces.
Right.
Which you could probably manage, but I feel like there is not that situation where women have so little institutional power that they end up having these weird, like, machinations behind the scenes.
Yeah. And certainly the idea that sort of all of this came out of a woman posing nude for the sale of nude photographs of women.
Although I can kind of believe that, because the idea isn't just that she's posing nude, it's that she is this daughter of this very important, or at least very wealthy general.
Right, fair. Tycoon, oil tycoon.
Although it's interesting that, so before I actually knew anything about The Big Sleep, I had read a Warren Ellis comic that is called Desolation Jones, that is in many ways a modern-day quasi-science fictional riff on The Big Sleep. But that the way that he, this is also just a Warren Ellis thing, but the way that he updates it is that the daughter, there are three daughters. The man who is murdered in this turns into a daughter who is on the lam, but is not just a missing presence for the whole thing. But that the issue is this man's extensive collection of erotic material, of like extremely rare erotic material.
Wow.
And that the daughter, the youngest daughter, who is the Carmen stand-in, has helped these men steal it, and that's why he's going after her.
Wow. So I guess that could work.
It's interesting because it sort of does maintain a lot of these general premises, but ends up giving the women a lot more agency in a way that actually becomes way more interesting.
So do you think that a third movie or some variation on this book could work, where women are more than just sort of pieces of cardboard?
I'm not sure. The thing is, I'm trying to think of good sort of hard-boiled movies that I've seen. Granted, like, seriously, this is not my strongest genre, but I feel like the last one that I've seen is Brick.
Oh, I haven't seen that. I was going to say L.A. Confidential.
Yes, L.A. Confidential is great. I think Brick was more recent, so, like, okay. That's the most recent thing I can remember. Which works explicitly because it's a pastiche. Because the thing that's interesting is that it's this weird tension between these high schoolers and the sort of gritty world of noir, which kind of works because this, you know, Manichean, gritty, sort of simplistic Philip Marlowe ideology is transposed onto high schoolers who do actually think like that.
That's fun. I just looked this up. This looks very good. And I guess Veronica Mars.
Yes.
When it comes out.
Yeah, I mean, that's the question. Like, I'm wondering if I'm just sort of being uncharitable towards it, or if B, it's one of those things where the influence is perhaps greater than the actual thing. And I feel like I'd need to go back and read the other stuff that I've read. Like, The Long Goodbye, like, to see if it's maybe just this, or if it's genuinely something that is not, that this is something that doesn't actually hold up.
Yeah, I had read a lot of the sort of reviews of this book, and sort of for looking for context on Raymond Chandler, they sort of point out The Long Goodbye as his, like, you know, the best book that he ever wrote. But that's a good question. I mean, I don't have enough context to know. Like, when I just read this, I was just like, don't like it. It's amazing to me to find out how much influence it actually had going forward. And so I guess I don't know what came before this book and this genre. And it's been really interesting to see how it did have such a huge impact on sort of novels and on filmmaking and on this whole genre that I was really not aware of. Because when I read it, I just thought, like, no, not for me.
Yeah. A lot of it seems to be historical context, that it was this moment, this very kind of cynical take on a moment that was around World War II.
Right.
But there's stuff that I genuinely really loved. I was reading a book called The Getaway by Jim Thompson, that in one of his books, Savage Night, which I still need to read, was on our poll. It was amazing. It's a book that is entirely about the aftermath of a bank heist. And this man and his wife, both of whom are similar to the sort of stereotypes that we've had in this book, but we spend much more time with them, are attempting to escape and get to a place called El Rey. And the entire book, almost, is them dealing with the law and seeing this thing just spiral out of control. And that it's basically about one very simple, very, very messy story, which is sort of the opposite of this, which is about 10 different stories.
Yeah.
Almost all of which get resolved very suddenly.
And I mean, it actually is like 10 different stories, or maybe not that many, but he did combine a bunch of short stories to create this book, right?
Yes. I don't know exactly how many, but he did. And that this left unanswered questions.
Right.
I didn't actually even pick up on during... I kind of knew, but there were so many plot points that I kind of missed them.
I mean, it was like all of the threads going on were pretty confusing. It wasn't until I was reading reviews of the book that I realized that there was... Who was it? It was the chauffeur.
The chauffeur crashes into the... crashes off a pier, basically, and we never really see it mentioned again.
No.
We see it mentioned, but only in terms of motive.
Right, and so we never know who killed him or how he died.
Yeah, which is, I feel like I seem to have remembered that he, you know, was killed because he was jealous of Carmen, but I'm not sure that actually, or jealous of Carmen's lovers, but I don't know if that actually holds up anywhere. Or if it actually ever comes up again.
No. Did it move the story forward? I can't even remember now. I mean, was it an important plot point in terms of pushing things ahead?
I believe it was an important catalyst because it's the thing that showed him that everything was sort of weird and that there was more going on behind the scenes.
Right, right. That it wasn't just about this one case of blackmail.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that was... weird. I mean, when I read that he had combined, I think it was two short stories to create this book and then cobbled together other little bits and pieces from other short stories he had written to sort of make a book that made sense and that flowed together. I mean, I've never heard of a writer doing that. I guess it's not like out of the question or it's not like offensive to me that he would do that. But I think it sort of explained a lot to me in terms of why I found the plot pretty tough to follow.
Yeah. Well, obviously very common for writers to write out a short story. Yeah. And I think I remember books that are in which a couple of short stories are combined, but the idea is that they're different elements in a world.
Yeah.
Or different sort of plot points. The issue here is that they are all occurring simultaneously. That it's not as if it's a series of murders that he's solving. It's a bunch of murders that he's solving all at once concurrently.
Right. And they all tie into one another.
Yeah.
Which I don't know in those – it would be really interesting actually to read those two short stories and see sort of how he wove them into one.
Yeah. I think I just remembered a quote that I believe is Raymond Chandler, which is, "Whenever things are getting boring, have a man walk in with a gun."
That sounds like a pretty good description of what's going on here. Yeah. That's really funny.
Which is – well, genuinely pretty good advice because the book does move really quickly.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's very, and I was about to snap my fingers, but we're on a podcast, so I can't. But it was very just sort of one thing to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. I mean, there wasn't a lot of time where Marlowe would like stop and think or reflect, or it was just one interaction to the next. Occasionally broken up with like him having a drink or a big dinner or lying down on his bed fully clothed.
Which is interesting because the only lines that I really seriously remember from the book are the sort of aphoristic parts, where he's making these general statements. Like, at the end, there's this passage that I actually thought seemed sort of odd and out of place, that is him pontificating on, you know, what the death of a man matters, whether this thing mattered at all to the person who actually death actually sparked this situation. And it's a really eloquent ending. But it's odd because it just goes between that and these extremely physical...
shenanigans.
Yeah. I think there's also one part where he looks at a chessboard and he moves a knight. A piece has been moved and he moves it back because it's a knight. And he says, "There is no place for knights here."
Oh, yeah. That was part of like this... I was reading sort of people overthinking the symbolism in the book. Or maybe not overthinking it, but thinking more than I do about this stuff. Talking about sort of the recurring presence of like knight imagery in the book. Like, I guess there's some scene at the beginning where there's a stained glass window in a church and it's a knight like saving a damsel in distress.
Yes, and then he brings it up at the end again and says the knight is still trying without much success or something like right. that to free the damsel.
Right.
Which is after he's finished this blackmail plot that is ostensibly about both protecting this old man and his daughter.
Right. And the idea being sort of that Marlowe is the knight in this, like, unsavory world. Yeah.
Which, essentially, he does manage to wrap things up about as well as he can because yeah. his whole motivation is protecting this old man from, quote, thinking that his blood is not only wild but rotten.
Right, right, yeah.
Which I actually really liked as a motivation.
I did too, actually, and I wanted to talk about that sort of this Marlowe fellow making, like, you know, $25 a day expenses to do this job and then sort of goes way, way over the line of sort of what's necessary to accomplish this and really gets himself into the deep end with these people. And sort of why is he doing that?
I've always meant to look up how much $25 a day actually
is. I was
is.
Thinking the same thing because there's one reference in the book to $15,000 and he's reflecting on, like, the prospect of life after making $15,000 and he says, like, I could own a house, a new car, buy myself a wardrobe of suits. And
four suits. Like, a whole four suits.
A whole four suits, but own a house, buy a car. I mean, yeah, I would love to know what $25 a day was worth.
Yeah, but anyways, more than that, yeah, it's the sort of cliche of that is the man with no real sort of fixed morals, but this strong sense of justice and duty that for which he is willing to do anything. In this case, it also seems kind of like yet another we must protect this man from the horribleness of women.
Right.
Because that's really what this whole thing is that Carmen, I'm assuming anyone reading this has either read the book or doesn't care. Carmen shoots the husband of the femme fatale, right. Vivian, because she has epilepsy. He refused to sleep with her and she has epilepsy.
Yeah. Yeah, one or both. As factors there.
Which is why she also tries to kill Philip Marlowe at the end.
Right.
But anyways, and that Vivian, attempting to protect her younger sister, makes a deal with this mob boss to dispose of the body, which he seems to just sort of throw it in a lake, so I'm not really sure how helpful he was.
Yeah.
But then he's able to blackmail her in sort of the long run, waiting for her father to die. And that sets off the entire thing, and that he has various sort of sub-figures that are making their own little plans. But it's that the entire plot is that women are so horrible that they just screw up everything.
And this poor old man in his greenhouse.
Who's a general... Sort of like, because I think everyone... I'm oversimplifying a little, but everyone who is really worthwhile is some kind of soldier. That they refer to Marlowe whenever he's being good as, you know, yeah, you're an old soldier.
Right.
You're
right.
Just like me, you're the general.
Right. That's a good point. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah.
Which I guess that's the other thing that I've heard about noir, which is that it is a series that is about sort of the clarity of war giving way to this world where you have no idea what's going on.
So sort of coming back from a yeah. war? Interesting. So this would have been post World War I?
Yes.
Yes.
And sort of during World War II, depending yeah. on the book.
Yeah.
Or after.
Huh. That's interesting. And sort of, I guess, this not glamorization of soldiers, but an admiration or sort of like referring to someone as a good soldier is obviously a huge compliment.
And that... Obviously, this isn't something that I think showed up in everything, but yes, that they were these fixed points, which either meant that they were, you know, able to actually be a force for good or that they were saps or, you know, not equipped to deal with this world.
And so do you think that Marlowe just had sort of the best intentions and just was intent on helping this man not find out the truth about his wild and out of control children, female children?
I assume it's that and just that is a front for being really wanting to be really good.
Yeah.
That the police are incompetent, or at least they are portrayed as incompetent. You want to show them up. You want to prove that you can crack this thing. And also, by the way, there's this guy and you want to help him.
Yeah. Huh. Well, now I like the book more now that we're talking about it. I want to know what Philip does in the next book.
I think he does kind of more of the same. Women try to sleep with him and he's like, you're terrible.
Does he always turn down the babes?
I think he doesn't always turn them down, but he's always kind of resentful.
Interesting.
And he's always trying to do this on his terms. He's like, I'm not attracted to you.
Well, he's just trying to do his job. You know, he's a PI. He's very busy.
Yeah. See, I just really like the book as a historical artifact, on top of the fact that it's a pretty compelling, if not actual story, kind of story setting and milieu and atmosphere.
For sure, yeah.
And that's really what I like about Cyberpunk, too, which is the sort of spiritual successor, is that it's these plots that don't make any sense half the time, but that the way they're told really creates what the book is. Mm. That you don't even have to understand what happens in Neuromancer to like Neuromancer.
Mm.
And I think most people actually don't understand.
Yeah. No, it certainly, I mean, I didn't have to stop reading it at any point. I think my recommendation to anyone who is listening to this and has not read it would be to read it in one go.
Oh, yeah. It was terrible trying to.
I put it down for a few weeks and then picked it up and had like 5 chapters left and was just had no idea who anyone was.
Yeah, at first I felt really terrible about that because I assumed it's just that I am a dumbed down reader of the 21st century.
Me too, I felt the same way. I was like, what is wrong with me? I can't follow this like very simple little novel.
And then, yeah.
But it turns out it was everyone.
Yeah, whatever we're reading next month, which is either Consider Phlebas, which is Ian M. Banks' big space opera, or The Left Hand of Darkness, sociological Ooh. Space opera, to be snarky, Ringworld engineering space opera, or Babel 17 linguistic space opera. All of these, even though I remember The Left Hand of Darkness as being very difficult, are fairly straightforward.
Yeah.
Books either, and also books I think generally about ideas, which I think is going to be really interesting.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of The Left Hand of Darkness, or actually I get this, all of Ursula Le Guin's books to me sort of like meld into one big college memory. But I think I really liked it.
Yeah. I remember reading it and just finding the sort of anthropological and political bits of it sort of at the time boring because I was a teenager.
Right. Yeah.
And it wasn't nearly as exciting as she has another book called The Lathe of Heaven. That's just about a guy whose dreams come true.
Oh, I haven't read that.
In sort of weird ways, and his psychiatrist starts controlling the world.
That sounds amazing. Dreams. I think I want to read that next.
So Ringworld is winning, though.
Oh.
Which is a book that is perhaps most notable for actually creating the physics and sort of mathematics necessary to run a giant ring around a planet, arguably.
Oh, this sounds good. This sounds like a Verge science book.
And then after that, everyone else created Ringworld. So I think there's actually a Ringworld in Consider Phlebas, and it is what Halo is based on.
Wow.
Or it is not what it is based on, but Halo incorporates a Ringworld.
Well, it sounds like we have lots of interesting things to look forward to for January.
Yes, and hopefully none of them will be infuriating. Actually, Ringworld is going to be. Yeah.
Okay.
So have fun with that. But otherwise, thanks for tuning in, and I think that's probably good for us.
Yeah, I think I'm all set here.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any last words?
Oh, you know, I think I would just tell everyone that they should definitely watch Bored to Death if they haven't. It's a fantastic TV show. It's very funny. And, you know, think about giving this a read, but it doesn't get the Drummond endorsement.
Also, look in our forums. We have a fantastic flowchart, Philip Marlowe's Guide to Dealing with Women.
Yes, definitely check that out. It's hilarious.
All right.
Goodbye, everyone.